The U.S. defense industry is large, complex, and competitive. It is also lucrative for those companies able to navigate it successfully. The American Society of Military Comptrollers helps bridge the gap between the boardroom and the battlefield while supporting transformation in the defense sector. The Business of Defense podcast brings you inside the companies working to achieve this, directly from the business leaders, and to understand how they create value for their companies and their customers. For more information on ASMC, visit asmconline.org.
Welcome to this throwback edition of the award-winning Best of the Left podcast, where we remember the past and choose to repeat it. Today's episode was originally published on February 7th, 2018, and I'm playing it today as the war in Gaza continues, because I think it provides good context for why I think it was right to oppose this war from the very beginning. For me, the best reason to have opposed the invasion of Gaza had nothing to do with whether Israel has the right to defend itself or any ridiculous conspiracy theories that were thrown around about October 7th. It was about the history of the conflict, but not the deep history about judging the claims to the land or whatever. I just mean the history of how consistently Israel goes overboard in the violence they inflict on Palestinians. There was a poll about a month ago saying that half of U.S. citizens then believed that Israel had gone, quote, too far in their war in Gaza, up from 40% at the beginning of November. I'm sure that number will only continue to climb. If you had polled me on October 7th, I would have said that Israel will go too far, and so everyone's just catching up with that perspective. And it's not that I'm clairvoyant, I've just been paying attention. Sources today include Counterspin, Democracy Now!, Intercepted, The Majority Report, and The Real News.
Israeli soldiers shot 14-year-old Palestinian Mohammed Tamimi point-blank in the face with a rubber-jacketed bullet on December 14, 2017, in Nabi Saleh, a small village in the occupied West Bank. The boy was placed in a medically induced coma. An hour later, Mohammed's 16-year-old cousin, Ahed Tamimi, slapped and kicked at an armed Israeli soldier in the entrance to her family home. After video of her actions went viral, Israeli soldiers raided the Tamimi home at 3 a.m., arresting Ahed and confiscating the family's phones and computers. Ahed Tamimi has been denied bail and could face years in prison. As Gregory Shupak wrote for Fair.org, a January 1st Newsweek article described the incident as the teenager assaulting Israeli soldiers, threatening to Israeli soldiers and then hitting them in the face, pushing the soldiers as well as kicking them, hitting them in the face and throwing stones at them. Newsweek called her actions assaults and an attack. It failed to report that Israeli soldiers had just shot her 14-year-old cousin. CNN, Shupak reports, also ran a piece that left out the most serious act of violence that day, as did Reuters and the Associated Press. Newsweek and CBS left out the occupation that structures every interaction between Palestinians and Israelis entirely. And none of the pieces noted that occupied people have a legal right to resist occupation. A New York Times story described Nabi Saleh as having long-running disputes with a nearby Israeli settlement, Chalamish, that Nabi Saleh residents say has stolen their land and water. The paper did not say that Chalamish is illegal under international law. Finally, Newsweek says Tamimi has now been indicted on 5 counts of assaulting security forces, that she's charged with interfering with the soldiers' duties by preventing them from returning to their post. But as with other accounts, readers would not know that the proceedings are taking place in a military court. Tamimi is being tried by the same occupying military that shot her cousin. According to the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, the military court system Palestinians in the occupied West Bank face, quote, does not grant the right to due process and the rights derived from it, close quote.
Thank you.
Our guest today, author and scholar Norman Finkelstein, author of the new book, Gaza, An Inquest into Its Martyrdom. The book published as Israel's facing a possible international criminal court war crimes probe over its 2014 assault on Gaza, which killed more than 2,100 Palestinians, including over 500 children. I want to turn to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu talking about the 2014 military offensive in Gaza. He was speaking to Brian Williams of NBC News.
You know, at a certain point, you say, what choice have you got? What would you do? What would you do if American cities, where you're sitting now, Brian, would be rocketed, would absorb hundreds of rockets? You know what would you'd say? You'd say to your leader, a man's got to do what a man's got to do. And you'd say, a country's got to do what a country's got to do. We have to defend ourselves. We try to do it with the minimum amount of force or with targeting military targets as best as we can, but we'll act to defend ourselves. No country can live like this.
That was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu justifying the 2014 military offensive in Gaza, that the International Criminal Court is apparently about to open up a war crimes investigation into.
Well, Benjamin Netanyahu says two things. Number one, Israel had no option. And number two, that it used the minimum amount of force. Well, let's look quickly at those two points. Point number one, everybody agreed that the reason they went, once the fighting began, Hamas had one goal. The goal was to end the siege of Gaza, to lift the siege. Under international law, that siege is illegal. It constitutes collective punishment, which is illegal under international law. The siege has been condemned by everybody in the international community. He had an option. He didn't have to use force. He simply had to lift the siege. And then there wouldn't have been a conflict with Gaza. Number two, he claims he used minimum force. There's a lot to say about that. You can decide for yourself whether it's minimum force, when Israel leveled 18,000 homes. How many Israeli homes were leveled? One. Israel killed 550 children. How many Israeli children were killed? One. Now, you might say, well, that's because Israel has a sophisticated civil defense system or Israel has Iron Dome. I won't go into that. I don't have time now. But there's a simple test. The test is, what did the Israeli combatants themselves see? What did they themselves say? We have the documentation, a report put out by the Israeli ex-service, ex-combatant organization, Breaking the Silence. It's about 110 pages. You couldn't believe it. You know, I'll tell you, Amy, I still remember when I was reading it. I was in Turkey. I was going to a book festival. I was sitting in the back of a car and reading these descriptions of what the soldiers did. My skin was crawling. I was like shaking. Soldier after soldier after soldier. Now, bear in mind, you want to say they're partisan, the soldiers? Read the testimonies. They're not contrite. They're not remorseful. They're just describing what happened. There's no contrition. These aren't lefties, supporters of BDS. What do they describe? One after another says, our orders were shoot to kill anything that moves and anything that doesn't move. One after another says, Israel used insane amounts of firepower in Gaza. Israel used lunatic amounts of firepower in Gaza.
These were the Israeli soldiers.
The soldiers, they're describing it. One after another says, we blew up, destroyed, systematically, methodically razed every house in sight. What does that mean, every house in sight? 70% of the people in Gaza, they're refugees. It means they lost their homeland. The last thing they have, the only thing they have, the only thing they've ever had is their home. And the Israelis went in like a wrecking crew with their D-9 bulldozers.
Explain how it began.
How what?
How the 2014 Israeli military invasion of Gaza.
These are hard things to explain because it depends on where you want to start. Where I start is at the end of April 2014, a national unity government was formed between Israel, between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas. And the United States and the EU, surprisingly, they didn't break off negotiations with this new unity government, although it included a terrorist organization. And it enraged...
You're using air quotes. You're saying what the U.S. called a terrorist organization.
What Israel calls a terrorist organization. Because at that time, the U.S. was willing to negotiate. And Netanyahu went into a rage because he was being ignored over Iran. Now he's being ignored over Hamas. And so he finds a pretext. I don't want to go into the details now. He finds a pretext to try to provoke Hamas into reacting so that he can say, you see, they're a terrorist organization. And then it quickly spiraled downwards, as it typically does. And then Israel went in. There was the air assault. And then July 17th, the day the Malaysian airliner went down over the Ukraine, Netanyahu used that moment. The plane was downed in the afternoon, and he launches the ground invasion in the evening. You'd be surprised how finely attuned the Israelis are to the American news cycle. They begin Operation Protective Edge in 2008 with Obama's election to the presidency on November 4th. They begin the ground invasion of Gaza during 2004 was Operation Cast Lead. They begin Cast Lead in November 4th, 2008, when Obama's elected president. They begin Operation Protective Edge, then ground invasion on July 17th, when the airliner is downed over the Ukraine. All the cameras are now riveted over there. And so they launch the attack. And the attack was, well, let me just quote to you Peter Maurer, who was the head of the International Committee of the Red Cross. And I was even surprised by his remark. Peter Maurer said, and I'm quoting him, paraphrasing him, but almost verbatim. He said, in my entire professional life, I have never seen destruction as I saw in Gaza. And that's coming from the head of the International Committee of the Red Cross, who is accustomed to witnessing war zones. What was done there was, it was a crime against humanity. You take a place like Shijaya. Shijaya, it's a very densely populated neighborhood of 90,000 people. Israel dropped, believe it or not, it's hard to even fathom, more than 100 one-ton bombs on Shijaya. More than 100 one-ton bombs on Shijaya. Did the same thing to Rafah, did the same thing to Kuza, did the same thing to the whole Gaza Strip. And then you have this guy come along, and he said, we used discriminate force, we used proportionate force.
I wanted to go to, after an attack on a UN shelter in 2014, the Israeli military attacking in Gaza, which killed many Palestinian civilians, the spokesperson for UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, broke down and cried during an interview in Al Jazeera. His name is Christopher Gunness.
The rights of Palestinians, even their children, are wholesale denied, and it's appalling.
Christopher Gunness is starting to cry. That's Christopher Gunness as the camera turns away from him, his head in his hands, later tweeting, there are times when tears speak more eloquently than words, mine pale into insignificance compared with Gaza's. Norman Finkelstein, we have 2 minutes left.
I happen to know Chris Gunness. He's a really terrific guy. I hope he doesn't lose his job because I said that. But he is a special guy. He's an unusual guy. He worked in Gaza. He's married to a man. He's married to a Jewish man, and he's married to an Israeli man. So you can imagine that Hamas was not was not thrilled with him. But he's very principled, and the tears were real. Anybody who lives there, has even passed through there, their heart breaks. That's what's been done to the people of Gaza.
What do you think needs to be done now?
Well, it's clear the first thing that has to be done is the siege has to be lifted. And the UN Human Rights Council, although its report was a total and complete whitewash and disgrace, Mary McGowan Davis was the author of it. They did say, according to the law, the siege has to be lifted immediately and unconditionally. That's the law. It has to be lifted immediately and unconditionally. That's the first thing that has to be done. The siege has to end, the occupation has to end, and the people of Gaza, after 50 godforsaken years, should have the right to breathe and live a normal life.
And how do you think that's going to happen?
It's a very tough moment right now, but there are always possibilities. In my opinion, there is the possibility in Gaza of a nonviolent mass resistance trying to force open the checkpoints and the West Bank. I don't have time to go through it now. I think a mass strategy of smacking Israeli soldiers, women and girls, in the footsteps of Ahed Tamimi, that kind of
who
strategy.
Who faces many years in prison right
yes,
now.
Yes, nobody's saying it's without risks.
10 seconds.
But just as the children of Gaza, when they threw stones at the Israelis in 1988 during the first Intifada, shifted international public opinion, I think the people, the women of Gaza, if they have a Me Too campaign, I smacked an Israeli soldier today, I think that can win international public opinion also.
You talked about a nonviolent campaign throughout the occupied areas.
Look, I'm in the tradition of Gandhi, and Gandhi was very clear. When you're facing huge odds against you, and you use kinds of force like scratching, slapping, kicking. Gandhi said, that's not violent.
What does Israel have to do with local policing in the United States?
Well, Israelis are actually training local police and private security forces all over the world. That's really one of their big businesses. But what's so fascinating to me about this story is that it's been on my radar at least for a decade, if not more. It's something that's not a secret by any means. I mean, these trips are advertised on the websites of the groups that sponsor them. And yet it is never talked about. It's really fascinating to me that even now that we have so much attention on police departments in the US, on the militarization of police, the fact that these officers, and we're talking about hundreds of them, are going to Israel yearly to train with military forces there. It's just not talked about. And I think that's quite fascinating.
I mean, I first encountered Israeli private security in 2005 when I was in New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. There was a firm called Instinctive Shooting International, ISI, that was hired to guard a wealthy white enclave in New Orleans. And when I was researching that time, I was sort of stunned to see how deeply embedded Israeli firms are in every level of the U.S. Homeland Security apparatus in terms of training, and also the national security apparatus. That, to me, I think is one of the most disturbing aspects of this, that Israel is viewed in the world as one of the most efficient assassins that exists on the international scene. And now they're increasingly working with American police forces armed with what are clearly weapons of war, not policing.
Right. You think American cops don't need any further militarizing, but I guess you can always get better at killing, I suppose. But no, I actually met Israeli security forces in Haiti in the aftermath of the earthquake there in 2010. So they're everywhere. This is like a huge business for Israel. It makes sense, right? When your entire country has gone through the military and everybody has military experience, that's, you know, a great thing to have in your resume if you're going to look to make money, that's something you can market. And what's really interesting is they've been able to market their experience in the occupied territories, and their occupation of Palestine has become this selling point, really, that's put on brochures that sort of highlight Israel's strength as a counterterrorism force. But when they train American cops on counterterrorism, a majority of what they're teaching them ends up being used against civilians in the U.S. I mean, most police departments in the U.S. do not face serious terrorism threats.
This is an incredible part of your story. I just want to share this with our listeners. You write, in the aftermath of 9/11, Israel seized on its decades-long experience as an occupying force to brand itself a world leader in counterterrorism. U.S. law enforcement agencies took the Jewish state up on its expertise by participating in exchange programs sponsored by an array of pro-Israel groups like the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, and the Anti-Defamation League. What on earth are those lobbying entities doing arranging counterterrorism, so-called counterterrorism training for U.S. police forces?
I mean, and I think perhaps the most ironic of them is the Anti-Defamation League, which really presents itself as a civil rights organization that here in the U.S. counters supposedly abusive policing. And they, in the aftermath of Ferguson, have been very strongly opposed to people that draw comparisons between the occupation of Palestine and the militarization of police in the U.S. You know, a lot of people in Ferguson were sort of comparing themselves to Gaza, which is questionable in many ways, obviously. But there is definitely a solidarity that's being built between occupied people in different ways.
Right. And you talk about in recent days, there was this delegation of top U.S. law enforcement officers in Israel for a seminar that was sponsored by the Anti-Defamation League. It was a national counterterrorism seminar. Topics such as leadership in a time of terror, balancing the fight against crime and terrorism. More than 200 law enforcement executives from over 100 departments in the U.S. participated in this?
Having participated in this since 2004, when it first launched. This week, there were several top U.S. officials. Sometimes immigration enforcement agents also participate. Sometimes campus police participate in these trainings. They go to Israel and they learn from Israeli police as well as the IDF, so the Defense Forces military, as well as security forces that really work on border patrol. And I think the most important thing to remember here is that these are U.S. cops that are tasked with enforcing civil law and criminal law here in the U.S., but they're learning from people that are enforcing military rule over occupied people. So the parallel is really quite interesting. I mean, Israeli security forces operate in a non-democratic context, and these are U.S. public servants that are learning those tactics, presumably to bring back and use against U.S. citizens.
You specifically talk in your article about the Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police Commander, Morgan Kane, who attended the training. What did the D.C. police say to you when you reached out to them?
Right. So, well, first of all, we only know about Morgan Kane, who's a female commander, actually, in D.C. And we only know about this because Jewish Voice for Peace, which is one of the organizations that's been exposing the strips, was able to find her name in a document they FOIA'd. And so I reached out to the police department in D.C. And basically, they, as many others, really framed the strip as a counterterrorism opportunity. It's an opportunity for DC police to learn, you know, techniques that will keep DC residents and tourists safe. That's really what they present. Never mind that DC also has major problems, as many other cities do, with policing its own poor black, brown citizens. It has a history of, you know, abuses. There have been a number of police killings there, as there have been in other cities. And so it's really difficult to kind of draw a line and say, I'm learning about counterterrorism and I'll come back and not use it against everybody else and still police in a constitutional manner. I mean, these things really are connected. You can't separate one from the other. There's kind of this idea that counterterrorism is okay, but non-constitutional policing isn't. And even on the counterterrorism front, I mean, there's plenty, obviously, of abuse that comes out of these strips. For instance, the NYPD infamous Muslim spying program a few years back, that was pretty much modeled on the surveillance of Palestinians in the West Bank. And one of the officers, one of the top commanders actually in the NYPD that was behind it, had participated in one of these trainings in Israel. So you really see these techniques and how these methods are brought back home and put in place against U.S. citizens, in this case, Muslim citizens. But one other thing I would point out is that the exchange also goes both ways. I mean, you'd think Israelis don't have anything to learn from Americans in terms of oppressing populations, but they do. And one thing that, for instance, happened last year in Israel is that the government passed basically the equivalent of our stop and frisk law, which, of course, has been very much contested in a number of US cities. Meanwhile, in Israel, this new law is essentially doing the same thing. And of course, because the law itself is so vague, where basically any officers can stop anyone they suspect of being up to something, essentially, that's been applied very discriminately. And it's, you know, with racism towards Palestinians.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of cohesion between how the US conducts itself in the world and how Israel conducts itself in Palestine. And increasingly, we're seeing those two merge in the US. But I wanted to get your analysis on, once again, the violence that we saw of the police in St. Louis in recent days.
I mean, I always feel like St. Louis is just a little bit ahead of the rest of the country in terms of finding out the flashpoints and really sort of showing you in a nutshell what policing and the relationship between police and Black and brown communities in this country is. As you know, I was in Ferguson 3 years ago. I'm kind of beginning to see the same thing happening again. I don't know if you saw from people that were on the scene, there was a moment when after making a number of arrests, police reportedly started chanting,
"Whose streets are streets?
Whose streets are streets?" Which is, of course, the protester anthem by default. And the fact that police would have really the arrogance and the nerve to chant this in the streets that they are supposed to serve is just astounding to me. So really, St. Louis, I think, captures this kind of conflict. St. Louis has in the past been an indicator of how these conflicts will play out. So we'll be watching for sure.
Have you seen this clip of Richard Spencer on...
No, I have not.
This is interesting. So Richard Spencer was interviewed on Channel 2 News with Donny Kushmaro. It's Israeli news. And it's interesting because, one, you get to see how Richard Spencer wants to portray this movement of fascism. And we should note that Bibi Netanyahu's son said that the left is far more dangerous than these fascists. But here's Richard Spencer equating his fascism with Zionism. And it's an interesting analog. Here we go.
You know that you're speaking now with a Jewish journalist, that most of our viewers are Jews. How should I feel?
As an Israeli citizen, someone who understands your identity, who has a sense of nationhood and peoplehood and the history and of an experience of the Jewish people, you should respect someone like me who has analogous feelings about whites. I mean, you could say that I am a white Zionist in the sense that I care about my people. I want us to have a secure homeland that's for us and ourselves, just like you want a secure homeland in Israel.
I mean, I think it's a little bit facile. There's perhaps some element of analogy there, although I would say that the impetus for a Jewish homeland came from basically at the hands of an ideology that Spencer is espousing.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, at its base, it's incredibly offensive that Israel is founded in light of the Holocaust, which Spencer is totally in line in, and we shouldn't be shy about saying it. And at the same time, Israel is an apartheid state today. And it tracks with that sort of politics. That's also reality.
Yeah, that is the problem, is that they have, since their founding, or since I would say probably closer to the past 30-some-odd years, begun to, I mean, maybe there's an argument that it naturally would result in this, but I don't think it had to, where they are denying a huge percentage of the, not their citizens, but the people they control, rights as citizens in their country. That's very problematic. And they're doing it in the name of national security. And it certainly makes it too easy for someone like Richard Spencer to make that analogy.
And when you get into Gaza, and I mean, the whole other dimension of keeping it on a diet, according to one Israeli general, I mean, and there's no, there's also a longer history of the neo-fascist parties in Europe drawing connections with at the very least the right in Israel. And if we're being real, I mean, the left is totally marginal. I mean, the only party that operates at all in Israel in the quasi mainstream, and they're still pretty marginal, that we would recognize as like liberal, is Meretz. Labor, and that is not center right, and everything else is hard right. And many of Bibi's cabinet are referred to the right of him.
I'd be curious as to how that interview played in Israel.
I think there's clearly a contingent now in Israel that doesn't have a problem. They don't see themselves as liberal internationalists who want to protect the Jewish identity. They see themselves as ethno-nationalists, more in line with what he's talking about.
Right. It's a problem. It's a real problem. It's a problem both in terms of what how it reflects on Israel, and it's also a problem to see that guy. I mean, as he goes on after that, he poo-poos conservatives and really wants to project a sort of a professionalism and a reasonableness. I should add that the United States was not founded as a white country.
No, it was not.
And I would also add that to the extent that there's a significant number of African Americans in this country, not necessarily their choice.
Right. From the founding, we commit genocide to get the place to begin with,
right,
and then import slave labor.
And, I mean, to be fair, in terms of the analogy, you had to, at the very least,
there was a cleansing of Palestinians in the late 40s. There's no doubt that's objective history.
I'm here with Ilan Pape, Israeli revisionist scholar, I guess we could call you that. And you're coming out with two new books, and I just got a galley of your latest, which is called The Ten Myths of Israel.
That's right.
So what is the biggest myth about Israel? Would it be, a land for a people, without a land? Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. I mean, what do you think the biggest myth is?
I think it's very difficult to choose, and that's why
you didn't have it like a top 10 list.
I chose chronology as the main regulator for the myth. So I began with the land without people and people without land. But I really think that the biggest myth of all has to do with how each of this myth does not allow us to understand the real nature of Zionism and the project of Zionism and the nature of Israel today.
Yeah, I think when you listen to Netanyahu, and he's sort of this master of expounding on this myth that Israel's not only not a settler colonial state, but that it's sort of a normal democracy that has flowered out of the Middle East almost organically because of the Jewish ancestral connection. And then when he talks about the conflict, or I wouldn't even call it a conflict, I'd call it a crisis. He always goes back to the Hebron riots. He goes back to these events that occurred before the State of Israel was founded, for example, attacks on Jewish communities in Jaffa, and never explains how those communities came there and what the real story was. So how do you challenge Netanyahu's narrative of Jewish Arab relations in historic Palestine?
I think it's deeper than that. And Netanyahu in this respect represents a very deep Israeli Jewish conviction that they are the indigenous people of Palestine and the Palestinians are the settlers.
Yeah.
They are the aliens.
Yeah.
And this is the starting point. The starting point is we are the indigenous. Yes, we haven't been there for a few hundreds of maybe 2,000 years, but we are the indigenous people of Palestine. And from there, everything else emanates. And I think the way to challenge it is really by using this paradigm of settler colonialism, because it's not exceptional for a settler colonial movement to claim to be the indigenous people of the place that they occupy, colonize, and quite often genocide. It happened before in other places. And I think that's something that allows people who either were victims of other settler colonial projects or people who are part of settler colonial states like the United States, right, but are very familiar nowadays with their own history, right, and understand their own origins, to understand that actually it's not exceptional. It's not an exception. The only exceptional part of it is the denial, yeah, not the very historical act itself.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of these myths are actually just Hasbara arguments by, in many cases, morons for the consumption of morons. But I found that in our world, there are a lot of, I mean, it falls on fertile soil. I mean, the education system isn't very good in the West. So you have these Netanyahu, and I think, you know, this is kind of a common feature of Hasbara, trying to draw a distinction between settler colonialism and traditional metropole colonialism. And you'll hear him say, you know, we're not the French colonizing Algeria. We have nowhere to go back to. You know, this is our homeland and we can't go back anywhere. You know, how do you respond, yeah, to that? And, you know, I think, you know, one of the things that we've failed to do is explain how settler colonialism is in many ways more pernicious than traditional colonialism.
Absolutely. The exceptional part of the story is that settler colonialism made certain connections or made certain assumptions which were accepted in the 19th century but looked ridiculous, inhuman, and non-democratic in the 20th century. And yet, in the particular case of Israel, they still remain valid. For instance, the claim that the only way you can create a democracy in a country which has settlers and natives is if the settlers are always the majority, which is the argument of the liberal Zionists, not the right-wing Zionists. The liberal Zionists, the whole peace process is based on the idea that the only way democracy can be sustained in Palestine is if the Jews are a majority in their own homeland.
Right.
So this is a ridiculous assumption that in any other context would be rejected as racist, but in the case of Israel is accepted.
Right.
And I think that's where the interesting part of the analysis comes into, I think, and also in my book, in the 10 minutes, why educated, well-read people in the West did not see this, or did they see it and decided to accept it for reasons of guilt, anti-Semitism, because they didn't want the Jews to stay in Europe. God knows why. Everyone had their own reasons for that. For the second point that you were making, I think that it's very important to highlight, when you talk about any settler colonial project, what Patrick Wolf called the logic of the elimination of the native. That you cannot create a new settler colonial society or a settler nation state from the settler colonial's perspective, as long as there is an indigenous native population there. So you have to get rid of them.
Genocide
them as you did in America, or impose apartheid and Bantustan on them as you did in South Africa, or ethnically cleanse them as you did in Palestine. The means vary from one historical, yeah, case study to the other. The logic is the same logic. And what is amazing is that this logic is still legitimized in the 21st century, in the case of Israel, under the guise of slogans such as the only democracy in the Middle East, a country that wants peace but doesn't find the right partner for it, and all the other mythologies that are connected to the peace process.
Yeah, I think that the logic of the underlying logic of Zionism, of maintaining a demographic majority, a sort of ethnic overclass through, violent demographic social engineering, is scarcely ever interrogated in our mainstream media, in academia. It's even very rare to see it. Would you say that that has fueled the rhetoric and the politics of the far right in Western Europe and in the United States, where you hear someone like Stephen Bannon, who's the chief counselor to Donald Trump, the main intellectual force behind him, say at a major conference in Washington that the United States is not just an economy, it has to represent a culture.
We have wide and sometimes divergent opinions, but I think we, the center core of what we believe, that we're a nation with an economy, not an economy just in some global marketplace with open borders, but we are a nation with a culture and a reason for being.
You know, it's this culturalist narrative, which implies that the United States is white and Christian, and it must maintain a white Christian demographic majority. Do you think that that has anything to do with the legitimization that Israel's experienced?
I do think so. I think if you are a member of a right-wing intellectual movement or ideological movement or political movement, you watch Israel desperately in a way. You say, my ideas, my assumptions, my discourse that is regarded as fringe, lunatic, and dangerous is welcomed when it is uttered by the spokespersons for the Israeli Jewish state or by Israel itself. It's exactly that. The dehumanization that Israel is allowed to express through its discourse, through its policies, through its activities, is not different from any racist approach by any other group. In fact, settler colonialism is one of the most dangerous forms of modern racism. It's not surprising that the two ways in which Israel was trying to challenge this or protect this kind of exceptionalism, because it's very precarious. It can, you know, one day the truth can be discovered and people would say, wait a minute, you're not different from an extreme right movement in America. You are the same, especially when the right wing in Israel becomes stronger. So there are two ways that trying to challenge it. One is by claiming that, we don't use violent means. If you're a liberal Zionist, we're not looking for violent means of keeping demographic purity. We're actually willing to give up some territory in order to keep demographic purity. Or we enclave, we incarcerate, right, we besiege the Palestinians in small Bantustan so that we will be demographically pure.
In Israel, it's liberals saying build the wall.
Absolutely, absolutely. And liberal, of course, because this means I don't want to use supposedly violent means. I'm not expelling people.
We're not going to transfer anyone.
Exactly. We're just not going to let them leave.
We're just going to say, it was Ehud Barak's campaign slogan.
Yeah, we are here and they are
us over
there.
Here, them over there. And we would recognize that here as sort of segregation.
Exactly.
But it's hard segregation.
Absolutely. And the second means by which they try to sort of hide it is the one that Netanyahu prefers, because he cannot say that he's willing to give up territory. And this is elevating this idea elevating anti-Semitism into supposedly a new phenomenon,
right,
and the new anti-Semitism. And to say that when you criticize Israeli settler colonialism, you're not criticizing racism, but you're actually racist yourself. Like the indigenous issue. If the Palestinians claim that they are indigenous, we will claim that we are the indigenous and they are the settlers.
Right.
It's this really new speak.
Which actually embraces the true logic of anti-Semitism that conflates Zionism with Jews and holds them responsible collectively for all of Zionism's crimes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's above another layer of uniformity or connection between the idea that Jews should be settler colonialists in Asia or the Arab world and not live as communities in the West, which is another kind of joint platform for anti-Semitism and Zionism.
Right, which opens the door for this kind of alliance of convenience we've seen with parties like the National Front in France. The Jobbik Party, even in Hungary, is moving away from its traditional anti-Semitism into a more pro-Zionist. We see the Austrian Freedom Party, Strache, was hosted by the Likud Party.
Absolutely.
This is a party founded by Nazis in Austria. He was hosted for a visit of the Holocaust Museum by the Likud Party. You go across the board to all these far-right parties down to Trump and the Republican Party, and they've all become pro-Israel while holding on to this idea that, you know, Jews really belong somewhere else.
And this is the whole notion of the Palestinians as immigrants. You have immigrants in Holland. And you have all the right to vote for a right-wing party because they are really Muslim immigrants and they create all the problem. We also have Muslim immigrants in Israel and they're using the same methods to identify themselves, to operate politically and violently against our own culture, our own set of values.
Right. We understand kind of, the terrorism that
absolutely.
You're experiencing. We have it ourselves.
And there are very worrying connections nowadays between the Israeli strategic advisors and experts and their counterparts in France, Britain, Holland, Denmark. They advise them how to control immigrant societies in order to preempt the next loaner. You know, the next
lone wolf.
And
it's, what, through biometrics and racial profiling and what do they call it? Micro expressions?
Micro expressions. And it's all built on this assumption. We all have Muslim migrant societies that did not fit in to the host culture.
Right.
And, that's quite a challenge for us to, it's so false. It's almost like the kind of Nazi propaganda that you have such a big lie that the bigger the lie is, the more difficult it is then to diffuse it. It's such a big lie that I think we're at the beginning, we're a bit paralyzed when we try to challenge it because it's so false. And yet I think we have to be patient and unpack it again for the audiences and make sure that people understand how ridiculous and dangerous it is for both case studies.
Thanks for listening to another throwback episode plucked from the archives to give you context for today. We also produce funny and informative bonus episodes featuring conversations between the Best of Left producers, as thanks to those who support the show by becoming a member or purchasing gift memberships to the show. If you get value out of the show, we'd appreciate your support at bestofleft.com/support through our Patreon page or from right inside the Apple Podcast app. As always, you can keep the comments coming in by leaving us a voicemail or sending a text to 202-999-3991 or by emailing me to j@bestofleft.com. You can also continue the discussion by joining our Discord community, and there's a link to join that in the show notes. So, coming to you from far outside the conventional wisdom of Washington, D.C., my name is Jay, and this has been the Best of the Left podcast, coming to you twice weekly, thanks entirely to the members and donors to the show, from bestoftheleft.com.